Okay, please be seated. Colleen Steet versus Christopher Jakich, 19 AP 1832 CR. Appearances, please. All right, good morning. This morning I have Attorney Bloodworth arguing for 25 minutes, followed by Attorney Jansen, 30, and then 5 in rebuttal, correct? Okay, perfect. Let's get going. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Carrie Bloodworth, and I represent Christopher Jakich. In the end, this case comes down to the plain language of the statute. So I would like to begin this morning by discussing the language of Section 971.17. The statute is silent regarding the court's authority to run separate commitment orders in separate cases consecutive to one another. This court has been consistent in holding that in order for a court to have the authority to run a particular disposition consecutive to another disposition, the statute must explicitly grant that authority. In the case of criminal sentences, for example, the legislature has explicitly given circuit courts the authority to run criminal sentences consecutive to one another. The statute specifically reads, and this is 973.15 sub 2, that the court may run criminal sentences concurrent or consecutive with another criminal sentence, whether that sentence be issued at the same time or previously. The statutes also explicitly authorize, with similar language, the running of, for example, probation consecutive to a criminal sentence. 973.09 sub 1 sub A gives circuit courts the explicit authority to do so. However, in cases where the legislature has not explicitly authorized courts to run consecutive dispositions, Wisconsin courts have consistently held that circuit courts do not have that authority. So for
I want to offer an argument and get your response to this area is maybe a little different than some of the other dispositions that are talked about in the sense that the length of time, the length of time is sort of uniquely tied to the length of a particular crime, right? Is there any logic or logical connection? What about the argument that because these are explicitly tied to the length of a sentence, that the starting presumption, or starting assumption we have, that it, unless it's explicitly there, it couldn't be allowed, but that it's structurally there maybe because it's explicitly tied to the length of any given criminal sentence. Could you respond to that, Rebecca?
Yes. I have two basic responses. My first would be that when the statute was drafted in 1989 and revamped, the legislature specifically did tie this to criminal sentences and the ability of the court in a criminal case to run sentences consecutive to one another. They did that explicitly by referencing Section 973.15 sub 2 within the NGI commitment statute. That gave courts the authority to, as Your Honor has stated, run NGI commitments consecutive in the same way that a criminal sentence could be run consecutive. In 2001, the reference to that statute was specifically eliminated from the statute, thereby eliminating the authority that the legislature had previously granted.
Just a moment. I want to just make sure one of my colleagues thinks the microphones are not on, so... I think they are.
Yours is on. Justice Hagedorn's is not.
Maybe I'll be louder.
That's fine.
I think I'd have to speak into the microphone.
No need.
How it is.
I was able to hear you, so.
Right, me too, but I wanted to make sure we didn't have a problem
here. My second point in response to your question is that we're not talking about a court's ability to set a specific term of commitment within a single case based on consecutive criminal sentences that might arise from the same single case. We're talking about the court's authority to run two separate commitment orders issued in two separate cases consecutive to one another. That authority, this court has consistently said, must be explicitly given. So, for example, in State versus Haar, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals said that an NGI commitment could not be run consecutive to a previous criminal sentence because there was no explicit authority in either 971.17 or 973.15 for the courts to do so. Similarly, with probation, which, as Your Honor acknowledged, is also based in part on the seriousness of the offense, in State versus Schwebke, the Court of Appeals said that probation terms cannot be run consecutive to one another because the legislature has not given courts the authority to do so. And finally, in State v. Woods, there was a similar holding regarding juvenile disposition.
Counsel, it's your position that even when they're in the same case, that you'd not be able to run them. Would you be able to do something similar to what the Court of Appeals functionally was doing? Is there any distinction between separate cases in the same case and the way you read the statute? So in the same case, you know, you're convicted of a crime, you know, two crimes, the maximum combined sentence is, you know, 12 years, but individually it's six. Could the Court of Appeals say I'm going to do two and two, or could it do 8-1-8-year, you know, NGI commitment? What's your view on that?
That issue has not been briefed, Your Honor, because that's not what happened in this case.
But it's important because it is exactly this case, because we're talking about reading the statute. It may not be what happened in this case, but whether you can do that or not wouldn't seem to matter whether it's separate cases or the same case.
So 971.17 addresses a court's ability to craft a term of confinement, a specific period of confinement, for a single case. Whether or not that statutory language permits a court, if there are multiple criminal charges that were pled NGI to within that single case, whether or not that statute authorizes a court to construct a single term of commitment based on consecutive underlying criminal penalties is a different question from whether or not it can then also take a separate case, a separate or commitment order, and run it consecutive to a commitment.
But it feels like if we take your argument and what you're asking us to hold on its face, it would apply to both. I guess I'm not understanding why what you're asking us to hold would apply differently in that fact.
So I'd like to kind of analogize this to the sentencing context in criminal. And I think that when you look at a criminal sentence, when someone is convicted and sentenced in one case and then convicted and sentenced in a subsequent, they have two separate criminal sentences, and the court decides whether they run concurrent or consecutive. The DOC then is responsible for calculating what's called a maximum discharge date. So the maximum discharge date is going to encompass all sentences. It's going to be a date at which it is no longer legal to confine this person. When the state has conceded in briefing that 971.17 is about that the court must issue a separate commitment order in each separate criminal case. When you read the text of 971.17, it requires the court to issue a specific period of confinement, a specific period not to exceed the maximum term of confinement in prison that could be imposed on an offender convicted of the same felony. That is within a single case. It says nothing about a court's authority to then run a separate case, consecutive or concurrent, which is what, for example, 973.15, which specifically states that a sentence may run concurrent or consecutive to any other sentence imposed previously. That's the distinction here.
Done with the answer?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so the statute uses the term a felony repeatedly in 1A and 1B. Why do you think it limits it to a felony if it means any felony or felonies? And then I have a second part to that. I'm unfortunately or fortunately old enough to remember pre-truth and sentencing one, pre-truth and sentencing two, and I think one related more to the old days and 1A, and then B relates more to when truth and sentencing changed things and had courts require confinement periods and extended supervision periods, both of which encompass the term of imprisonment. And confinement on separate felonies runs consecutive to, if you run the sentences consecutive, the confinement parts run consecutive to each other before you begin a term of extended supervision. How do you reconcile those things, all of those things, the term a felony and the reference to confinement, and how that would work if sentences were to run consecutive to each other, with your rationale and your argument today?
In terms of whether a felony can be interpreted as a plural or whether it needs to be interpreted as in the singular, I think is a red herring in this case. Let's say if we interpret felonies plural, the only authority that then gives the circuit court is to base the single term of commitment within that single case on consecutive, what the penalties would be for consecutive felonies within that single case. It does not go further and allow another order, commitment order in a separate case to be run consecutive to the first NGI commitment order. In terms of reference to the term of confinement, if I understand your question correctly, you're wondering how the changes in TIS from a parole system to a specific term of confinement,
I know how it works. This is how it works. If I commit two felonies, or someone I'm sentencing commits two felonies, and the sentences run consecutive to each other, the confinement part is served first.
Correct.
10 years plus 10 years. Then you go on to extended supervision in each of the two felonies. Let's just say it's 5 years plus 5 years, with the total term of imprisonment being, 10 plus 5, and another 10 plus 5 running consecutive to that. So it would be 20 years of confinement for the felonies that are committed.
Correct.
And so you would start with that. So the term of confinement really would be 20 years.
So that is if you interpret felony plural as felonies and you allow the single term of commitment in your single case to be based on consecutive underlying convictions. So in your case, it would be 20 years. Let's say someone later is found NGI in a second case and has a second commitment order. And that commitment order allows for the same 10 and 10 of ES or of initial confinement run consecutive with a maximum 20-year term of confinement in case two. The question in this case is whether those two 20-year commitment orders can be run consecutive to one another.
Wait. I had two felonies in the first case. So let's just assume 15-year sentence, 10 and 5. 15-year sentence, 10 and 5. So the initial term of confinement for the two felonies would be 20 years, not one felony. Are you saying that I could commit the person for 20 years?
Because
the maximum term of confinement's 20?
I'm not. I'm saying that even if you take the state's interpretation of felony to plural, which is not the really the question in this case, because we're talking about the court's authority to run separate commitment orders in separate cases. But
so
even
you're
if,
saying with the three felonies, so the two I'm sentencing on and the one that's later, the maximum this person ever can serve for an NGI is 10 years.
I'm saying that's not the issue in this case.
Well, it is really, because whatever we decide here will impact how trial judges and court around the state deal with whether or not multiple felonies all have meaning within the term of the statute, or whether committing one felony will limit what trial judges can do and how much, if at all, subsequent felonies have any meaning when it comes to an NGI, or whether they have any purpose or any additional time that is tagged on to that commitment.
So
it's as if you commit 10 felonies and they all have the same term of potential imprisonment, they're treated for commitment purposes as if you only committed one.
Your Honor,
that's your argument,
that
really.
That's not what I'm arguing, no.
Well, then how do they all have meaning under your argument? How do they all impact a term of commitment under your argument?
The purpose of commitment is not punishment. The purpose of commitment is the treatment of mental health.
I understand that, but 10 felonies equals one under your logic.
Two separate cases, two separate conduct, would not necessarily result in one 10-year conviction under my... So, for example, let's say you get a 10-year commitment in one case. 5 years later, you commit another felony. You have another 10-year commitment order in that case. That 10 years would start running on that day. So you would be realistically looking at 5 and 10 or something like that.
What if you have 10 charges in one complaint? A series of felonies for a series of years finally are caught.
That is not the situation that
I know, but you have to work with me here because that's really what we're answering. Limited to, and they all carry the same penalty. You're limited to one term of commitment under your logic. We can work with other scenarios, but really this case decides that very question.
The question posed in this case is whether separate commitment orders and separate felonies and separate cases can be run consecutive to one another.
All right, well, work with me. Try the one I just gave you. How's that work?
So I think in your situation, although this hasn't been briefed, the specific, the purpose of NGI commitments and the statutory history still reflect an intention to have those things run concurrent with one another as well.
So 10 felonies that span a period of years, finally the person's caught, they come to court, they're NGI. I'm limited to one term of commitment under your logic.
Yes, and I think that that is consistent with the purpose of NGI commitment.
Okay, and then if you have a case the next year, they found, oh gosh, there's more whatever, and it has the same term, you're saying that additional year really could tag on.
So a commitment would start running when the order is issued. So if there was, it would
tag on 1 year, even though it's an additional count that could carry an additional 10 years.
Well, if the commitment were issued for 10 years, then it would start at 10 years, correct?
Right. So it really would give you one more year.
Yes.
Okay.
Can I clarify, because based on the answers you gave to Chief Justice Ziegler, it appeared before that you were conceding that there's a way to read the statute that does give meaning to her scenario if there's 10 felonies in the one case, that each of those carried 10 that you could commit for 100 years. So, which is, I know your best argument. Okay, we've done this before, right? The platinum argument is the way you're arguing to us. Is there a way, a gold argument, or maybe silver, or maybe even bronze, however you, where you put it on there, but is there a way that you believe the statute could be read, if you don't win on that argument, to somehow allow for a court in the same case looking just at those crimes in front of the judge? So one case number, let's qualify it that way. One case number could have multiple counts, but that you could add up those counts and to reach the maximum. So you could be looking at a lot more than just one count. Is there a way to read it that way?
I don't think that the statute should be read that way. However, I think if the court agrees with the state's interpretation and the way that the state is arguing, that that's the furthest this court can go in holding that circuit courts have the authority to run consecutive, or to base a single term of commitment on consecutive felony or underlying penalties. Excuse me. I don't think that the state's argument gets you then to the next step of running separate commitment orders in separate cases consecutive to one another.
And that's what we have here. We have the two separate cases.
Correct.
Different case
numbers. What about if they combine the cases and there's a motion to consolidate and they consolidated the cases at the circuit court? Can you then have consecutive commitments?
Well, I think Your Honors put your finger on one of the problems with interpreting the statute to allow consecutive within a single case and concurrent within another. It allows the prosecution a lot of wiggle room in how they're charging things in order to get longer terms of commitment.
Why shouldn't it just be the term, the period, not exceeding the maximum term of confinement in prison that could be imposed on a felony?
Well, the question is whether that means a single, as Your Honor has stated, a single felony or multiple felonies. And the question in this case really is whether, assuming, you know, the court here, we have a two-year commitment in one case and a three-year commitment in a separate case. The court ran those 2 and 3 years consecutive to one another. The court didn't.
Because the periods of confinement could do that.
Well,
I mean, that's the law.
Within a single term, that's true. There was the 2 years in the first case and the 3 years in the second case were permissible as the terms of confinement within those single cases. The question is whether the legislature has then given you the authority, which, as this court has held consistently, it must do explicitly, to run those two commitments consecutive to one another. And
counsel,
our position.
I'm sorry, just I know you answered this question before, and we've been kind of going around and around, and it just maybe the coffee hasn't quite kicked in for me again. But when I just look at the statute that's in front of us, I don't understand the distinction between a separate case or the same case. The statute doesn't use any of that language. It simply talks about for any given felony. What you can do, you know, in terms of the maximum amount or the misdemeanor for the next statute. So I guess I'm and I thought you were making that distinction, allowing for that distinction, and I just am not seeing where in the statute that is. Could you point me to that?
So this, I think the state illustrates it very well, actually, in their response brief when they're discussing the problems with the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals did try to craft like a single commitment period that encompasses multiple commitment orders in multiple cases. And the state did a good job of explaining why that's not possible. And it really, if you take the example of timing, for example, if you have an NGI commitment in one case and 2 years later a separate NGI commitment in another case.
I agree with that. And that's why I guess my question is, it seems to me it's all one or the other. Whether you have two crimes in the same case or two separate cases charging the same crimes, the same standard statutorily seems to need to apply to both. I heard you saying it doesn't, and I'm trying to figure out where in the statute that argument comes from, because the statute doesn't, I don't see anything in here that would logically apply differently. And so I'm really more focused just on the statutory language.
Sure. So the statutory language requires that you craft a maximum term of or a term of commitment, correct, within a single case. The state concedes.
Where's the within a single case?
So the state concedes that it must be a separate commitment order in each separate case. Otherwise, we have constitutional problems. If you have a case that's 2 years later, and you're trying to then extend or change a commitment order that was issued 2 years prior by possibly a different judge. Practically speaking, we have commitment orders in separate cases. And this statute authorizes courts to craft a term of confinement or a term of commitment based on the term of confinement they could have imposed on an offender convicted of the same felony. That is in that single case. The state concedes that in their briefing. I also, before my time runs up, would like to talk about.
But that's the same felony, right?
I think the problem.
Meaning that count.
I think the problem might be, or the way I'm looking at it, and is it okay, Chief Justice?
Yes.
It seems that the result that you're asking, the anything other than the platinum or you don't win, whatever medal that is in between, it seems like that gets us to an absurd result. And that is that if you had a case where there were multiple counts within the first case we can do one thing. But if they are charged out in two separate cases, you have to do something that's totally different. And I think what Justice Hagedorn is asking is, where does it say that? And I think what I am saying is, how is that not absurd?
To clarify, when pressed, I would say that this court should not be running separate counts within a consecutive to one another either. I don't think that the statute allows for that. That's not what happened in this case. But I don't, and I want to go back before my time ends to the NGI, the purpose of commitments, because I do think it might clarify things. So the purpose is not to punish people for committing 3-4 felonies by tagging on commitment after commitment after commitment. The purpose is to treat mental illness and to protect the public. And that treatment and that protection of the public is supposed to be focused on the present need for treatment.
I think we all agree with you on that. You don't have to argue that. We get what the purpose of it is. Having said that, if I have a case where I have multiple victims, let's just say sexual assaults, multiple victims of sexual assault, I'll let you answer this on rebuttal, or multiple victims of anything, and the person pleads NGI on each one. We're making that assumption that they're pleading NGI on each one. Each NGI, I mean, let's say they're, you know, spread out through a series of a year. Someone's in a park and sexually assaulting people. And then they're found a year later. It's 12 separate counts, 12 separate victims. And there may or may not be NGI pleas on each of them. But just assume they are. You're saying each victim of each count, it's as if there's one victim when it comes to commitment. Just think about that a little bit, and you can answer on rebuttal, because I asked the question, and then your light went off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice Ziegler, and may it please the Court. Circuit courts may impose consecutive NGI commitments. This case boils down to whether the NGI commitment statute references the consecutive sentencing statute. If it does, Mr. Yakich concedes that the circuit court was authorized to impose consecutive commitments between these consolidated cases. Now, we already have an answer to this question. The NGI commitment statute implicitly references the consecutive sentencing statute because it ties the maximum length of an NGI commitment to the maximum length of a prison sentence. In other words, although an NGI commitment is not in itself a sentence, we have to turn to the sentencing statutes to determine how long an NGI commitment may last. That is what pulls in the consecutive sentencing statute, because the consecutive sentencing statute tells us how we determine how long a prison sentence, or the maximum length of a prison sentence, in a multiple offense situation.
Counsel, you argue it's implicit. The response, of course, is that explicitly the legislature removed reference to the consecutive criminal sentencing when it enacted legislation in response to TIS. It is quite clear to me that in 1989, when reference was put into, I'll call it sub 2 for shorthand, that is the criminal sentencing consecutive authority, consecutive sentences. It's quite clear to me that that was put in explicitly to allow for consecutive commitments. Do you agree with that?
I think that the explicit reference was added in the 1989 amendments to make the statute clearer. But we can't ignore that the 1989 amendments came right on the heels of CAJ, which already said and stands for the proposition that the NGI commitment statute implicitly references 973.15.2a.
So the answer to my question is that, yes, reference to sub 2 was explicitly put in to include the authority of the court to impose consecutive commitments. Is that correct?
I would say it was added to make that clearer, Your Honor. I think the authority, the textual authority, already existed for the reasons that I just gave, because of the parity that the legislature has between NGI commitments and criminal sentences.
Well, we have a multitude of cases. CAJ was a court of appeals case. We have multitude cases, and sometimes the legislature acts after those cases. Sometimes they track a holding of the case. Sometimes they don't, you know, in total. I mean, what we look for when we're here today is what does the legislature state? And they explicitly put it in 89 and explicitly took out that reference in 2001. So why should the implicit argument, and I need help on this, why should the implicit argument that you are advancing override the explicit actions of the legislature?
Because we have a binding Court of Appeals opinion that has not been abrogated by the legislature. And that binding Court of Appeals opinion has interpreted the text of the statute in its current form. I should say the language currently is identical in substance to the language at issue in CAJ. The Court of Appeals, in a precedential opinion, has said that language pulls in the consecutive sentencing statute.
I thought that the statute, the earlier statute, when CAJ was released and upon which CAJ is based, didn't give any authority of the court to impose a period of commitment. Rather, that was to the department. The court could deal with the, if you will, the discharge date and how it's computed. But it's a very different statute. The court had no, this question here today is what authority does the court have? And CAJ is based on a statute that gave the court no authority. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I certainly concede that the statute now is different than the statute back then, in that at the time of CAJ, it wasn't the circuit court setting the maximum period, right? As you said, it was DOC.
Mm-hmm.
I concede that, and now circuit courts are doing it. But I don't see how that changes anything. The question in CAJ was, when you have multiple NGI adjudications between multiple cases, how do you determine the maximum period, the maximum commitment period?
A difference of framework, or is it how do you determine the date of discharge? Isn't that what CAJ was about?
I don't see why the distinction makes any difference. The bottom line is CAJ said, here's how you calculate the duration of an NGI commitment when you have multiple NGI adjudications between multiple cases. That's the exact same question that we're here to answer today. Mr. Jakic was found NGI on multiple counts between multiple cases, and he's asking, how do we calculate the duration of the NGI commitment? CAJ answers that question.
Is your answer any different if there are not multiple cases? And I should have not made it a sexual assault. Let's say it's a substantial battery, someone in a park who keeps beating people up because sexual assault's treated a little differently. Would it make any difference?
No. To me, it's simply stated, the consecutive sentencing statute either applies or it doesn't. And if it applies, it's just like how sentencing courts handle multiple offense situations. If they have multiple counts in one case, they can make them concurrent or consecutive to each other or previously imposed sentences. If they have multiple counts between multiple cases presently before them, they can do it concurrent or consecutive. Or if there is a previous case, and they can make the new case consecutive or concurrent to the previously imposed case. It doesn't matter. The statute either applies or it doesn't.
On that note, counsel, you have invoked a rule that
the Wenke case first declared, as far as I understand it, that this court is bound by court of appeals decisions that are published. Of course, we're not bound by those decisions, right? We are the Supreme Court. Determined that the court of appeals misinterpreted the statute and rule to the contrary, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And your better argument or your best argument is based on the text of the statute, is it not?
It is. And what I would say is obviously Mr. Yakich hasn't asked this court to overrule CAJ in this case. That's one reason not to get to it. But I think more importantly, I think we know that CAJ is not objectively wrong because it has stood the test of time. It's been 30 years. The legislature has been put on notice that this language has been interpreted as permitting consecutive commitments because of the text of the statute. We do have textual authority to pull in the consecutive sentencing statute. The legislature has been on notice that that's how that language has been interpreted, and they have to do more. In terms of the history of the statute, I think the legislature had to do a lot more if they wanted to abrogate CAJ by removing an explicit reference to the consecutive sentencing statute when CAJ didn't rely on an explicit reference, and by leaving language in the statute that is identical in substance to the language of the statute at the time CAJ was decided.
So if we're not bound by CAJ, which we're not, and we're just looking at the text of the statute, I don't follow you. The statute used to say have a direct reference to consecutive sentences and allowing then for that in a way that other statutes do as well, as we talked about probation being consecutive to another sentence, for example. The legislature did do something. They took out that direct reference. So if we're looking at text, which is what we're supposed to do here, and we're not focusing on CAJ, I don't follow your argument about how we know now that it's supposed to be based on what the legislature said, consecutive. They've taken out the reference. We know that it's not a punishment. And so we would need something in there in order to do it.
It's there. It's there, Your Honor.
But I don't. I know you said it's implicit. I am having a very hard time following how. First of all, since when do we rely on what the legislature implicitly says? I thought we're supposed to look at the text. But even putting that aside, which I think is actually the bigger argument, I don't see the implicitness. Implicit? I don't see it. So if you can help me, that I would appreciate that.
Sure. So I concede that the statute doesn't explicitly instruct courts on what to do in a multiple offense NGI situation, but that doesn't mean it hasn't answered the question for us. It has tied the maximum length of an NGI commitment to the maximum length of a prison sentence, meaning you have to turn to the sentencing statutes to determine how long an NGI commitment may last.
But of course you do. How is that implicitly telling me you can do a consecutive? Of course you do. Now that we have truth in sentencing, the structure is totally different. Before it was an indeterminate term. Now there's a determinate term, and it's put on the courts to make that determination under truth in sentencing. Of course the court has to do that. How does that implicitly talk about consecutive sentences?
Because it tells the circuit court, you can't go... when you're setting the NGI commitment length, you can't go above the maximum prison length for this offense, right? And so we have to look at the sentencing statutes to find out what the maximum length is. And in a multiple offense situation, when a circuit court has multiple offenses in front of it on sentencing, the court looks to the consecutive sentencing statute to determine what the maximum prison sentence is.
Why would the court look to the consecutive?
Because that's what tells you what you can do. Can you run multiple counts? Can you add them up or not?
Okay, so if I'm, and I did a lot of sentencing, and I've got multiple counts in a criminal case, what allows the court to run them consecutive is the consecutive sentencing. But in each case, you're just looking at the maximum in that case. I'm not following how you need the... If you have different counts, why wouldn't you just be looking at each count the same way you would as if you're sentencing? And the only thing that allows for, I mean, sentencing lives as a result of statutes. If the legislature wanted to say no circuit court could ever make anything consecutive, they'd all have to be concurrent, they could say that, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I still don't understand. You're determining the maximum for each count. How does that then allow you to determine to make them consecutive? I'm not seeing the link, and maybe it's something that I just am not getting. But
sure. Could you maybe reframe your question, Your Honor?
Well, describing how when you have a multiple counts in a case, that you need the you turn to the consecutive sentencing statute to determine the amounts, but you really don't. You determine the amount based on each count. You turn to the consecutive sentencing statute to allow you to then run them consecutive to each other.
Right. And I'm
that,
sorry.
So does that help?
Yes. To be clear, when you're determining the amount, say it's 5 year. Let's say it's a 5 year in, 5 year out type of situation. You would look to a different statute to find that information out, to find that 5 years out.
Right.
But when we're talking about a maximum prison sentence in a multiple offense situation, what's going to happen is that if they're consecutive sentences, they're going to be treated as one continuous sentence by the DOC. And so we have to, when we say a maximum prison sentence in that situation, we're talking about adding up numerous counts.
Well, I don't know that I even agree with that premise that they're treated as one sentence. They're treated however the court orders them. They're either concurrent or consecutive to one another.
If they're consecutive, they're treated as one continuous sentence, and that's statutory.
The right. confinement portion
Correct.
Is treated as
Correct.
One confinement portion.
Correct.
Or, I mean, they don't let them in and out to do confinement, extended supervision.
Right. No, I understand.
That's yeah. what you're...
Okay. All right.
Well, so are you starting with 973.15? Because, of course, that gives the court the authority to impose as many sentences as there are convictions and provide that such sentence be concurrent with or consecutive to. So then when we're reading 971.17, the court shall commit the person for a specified period not exceeding the maximum term of confinement in prison that could be imposed on the offender convicted of the same felony. So you're, I guess as I'm understanding your argument, the legislature removes the explicit reference to 973.15, but it's still tying the maximum period of commitment to the maximum period of confinement. And sometimes the legislature just cleans up the laws because they take up a lot of space in the books, and sometimes they're really confusing with all these cross-references. But perhaps the argument is that the defense is according too much meaning to the removal of that statutory
I think that's
reference.
Exactly right.
Counsel, your opposing counsel talks about the purpose of NGIs. And so imagine for a moment you've got a case that comes forward to a judge and someone is still on – is serving an NGI term. So they have 10 years left, okay? And it was discovered that they, committed some other felony with a 4-year term of maximum imprisonment. Under your argument, the potential 4 years could be added at the end of the remaining 10, turn that 10 into 14, rather than looking at the current circumstance. And your opposing counsel, I think, it would make the argument, listen, NGIs aren't about punishment, and that doesn't make sense in the context of an NGI term of commitment that isn't about punishment, and that there's it doesn't fit with the overall structure of what's going on when you're doing an NGI. That NGI is looking at where you are right now and what's appropriate under your needs because of what happened. How would you respond to that argument?
So I think first what I want to point out, and I think it's important to consider today, is just because a court can impose consecutive commitments, it doesn't mean that the defendant is going to be serving the entire consecutive commitment treated as one continuous commitment. As counsel pointed out in her brief, the defendant can petition, if they're out on conditional release right away, they can petition every 6 months for early termination. And in fact, that happened in this case. He's done. And so I think that's important to keep in mind. But in terms of, certainly we can see that an NGI commitment, it's not punitive. It's not punishment. It exists to give the defendant mental health services, but also to protect the community. And so I think what we're saying here is by allowing courts discretion to impose consecutive commitments, we're really just ensuring that there's enough time to make sure the person gets sufficient mental health services and a sufficient amount of time to protect the community, keeping in mind that the court's going to be continuously reviewing this because the person's going to be petitioned.
So how would that work in my circumstance? So imagine somebody petitions for release, in my hypothetical, petitions for release. Are they petitioning for release from the maybe the initial 10-year remaining term that applies? What happens to the next 4 year? You know, how does that work?
I think it works as one. So this was my point of, even if we think about this in terms of multiple commitments run consecutively, they're treated as one continuous commitment. So it would, the person would be done. They wouldn't have to then serve a second commitment. Okay. It's treated as one continuous.
So which court would they petition?
I'm sorry?
How does that work? Which court would they petition? You've got two different courts in two different jurisdictions. You're running these consecutive under your reasoning. So now they want to petition a court. Do they petition the first court? Do they petition the second court? How does the structure of the statute allow for what you're saying? I mean, I get that DOC has ways of treating things, but how does that fit?
I think they would petition the first court, whichever commitment is being served first.
Okay, and if that court said they could be out conditionally, then that would be the case?
The statute directs the Department of Health Services to release the person if the
petition... If they're not consecutive, that affords no meaning to the second commitment, because that second victim, that second case, that second commitment, if it runs concurrent, or the second count, that victim, that person would have zero say when they come back to court. They wouldn't even be notified, probably. Let's say two different counties, two different victims. If everything runs concurrent, there is zero afforded to that second victim in that second or other count or case, because it's of no consequence. They have no say.
Right.
Is that a question?
Is that right? I mean, I could ask the question, but under that logic...
Well, let me make a declaratory statement here. On 971.17, this is my problem. As I interpret the statute, especially with the statutory history, with the explicit taking out the reference, or putting it in and then explicitly taking it out, I think that commitment orders in case different, each case has an order, and I think the commitment orders, there's no authority for consecutive commitments in this statute. I think this boils down, once you get to that question, then what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to, consistent with the language, determine how long? Right? That's how long. And the language says, this is how long, a specified period not exceeding the maximum term of confinement in prison that could be imposed on an offender convicted of the same felony. So you could arguably interpret that to mean, in a multiple count case, to include, as you argue, or the Court of Appeals ultimately concluded, that the maximum is calculated by saying, that case, in that case, the maximum could be consecutive, and so it is the broader number, right, the larger number, that can be set as the term of commitment, or you can just treat it by itself and not allow for the potential of consecutive sentences as to the multiple counts. So if you start with where I'm starting, and I'm really moved by the explicit putting in an explicit taking out of sub 2. How do you look at the language of the statute and know what is the maximum time? I mean, everyone is divining, trying to divine this. I don't think that's what we're trying to interpret.
When I first looked at the statute, I think you could make the argument that, well, this statute only tells us what to do if there's just one offense in one case.
You could make that argument.
You could look at that and say that.
Yeah.
But of course, that's not where we stop.
No, you could make it, just as the Court of Appeals did, maybe modified, but ultimately, you add the potential there for the consecutive sentences based on the multiple counts in the single case.
But I think you only get there by saying that, and whether you want to say it's an implicit reference, whether you want to say the consecutive sentencing statute indirectly applies, I think that the point is, I guess I'll put it this way, I think the breadcrumbs are there in this statute to take us where we need to go, which is to the consecutive sentencing statute, by telling us, look at how sentencing courts are handling multiple offense situations.
It depends on what silo you put this consecutive in. Do you put it in, you can have consecutive orders, or do you put it in the single silo with consecutive counts? You end up with the same number, right? Am I wrong on that?
No, right. But I mean, I think that's why I think the consecutive sentencing statute answers this question, because it tells us what to do in both of those scenarios.
Yeah. I understand that. I'm just having a hard time of this, the state explicitly, excuse me, the legislature explicitly taking out the reference that was put into, and then we're trying to just say, well, there are lots of reasons the legislature could have done that, you know.
But I
say baloney to that. I say, what does the text say? And
but I think we can't ignore the history of the statute.
No,
that's part of a plain meaning analysis, and the history of the statute shows that the most logical explanation for removing that explicit reference is because we already had a binding Court of Appeals case that interpreted language that is identical in substance.
I have a problem because the binding Court of Appeals case gave the court no authority whatsoever. The statute had no authority whatsoever for the court to impose a term of commitment. And so I'm not sure how relevant to me that is. And I say these almost like declaratory statements really for you to push back, because I'm trying to decide.
Again, yeah. that I don't see that the distinction between, well, back at when CAJ was decided, DOC was calculating the maximum, and now it's a circuit court. The point is that CAJ tells us, how do you calculate the maximum? I don't think it matters who's doing the calculation. And CAJ says it's based on consecutive.
Attorney Jansen, Attorney Bloodworth makes the argument that NGI commitments aren't sentences, which I think that you would agree with.
Yes.
And similarly, when sentence is withheld and someone is placed on probation, that is not a sentence, because the sentence is withheld and someone is placed on probation. And she also analogizes the situation to a juvenile order, a dispositional order in a juvenile case. And her point, as I read it, is that in those situations, probation or a juvenile dispo order that is not a sentence, those cannot be run consecutive. Probation can only be run concurrent. Same with the juvenile dispo order. And so I'm just wondering if you have a response to that argument.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. I would say that those arguments miss the mark in this case, because we're dealing with specific language in a specific statute that has been interpreted in a binding Court of Appeals opinion. And so I think that's all there is to it. The fact of the matter is, in this context, with this NGI commitment statute, a court has taken a look at this language and said, yeah, we think the consecutive sentencing statute applies.
Okay, when CAJ was decided, didn't it wasn't it referencing a statute that at that time had in it the reference to the consecutive sentence, 975.12?
Correct? I'm sorry.
The reference to consecutive sentencing was not taken out until after CAJ, correct?
There was no explicit reference to 973.15.2a at the time CAJ was decided. That's my point. The Court of Appeals got to the consecutive sentencing statute because of the parity between treating an NGI commitment like a criminal sentence. That's the textual authority that led the Court of Appeals and CAJ to the consecutive sentencing statute, and that textual authority still exists. And that's the state's argument here today.
But your argument is not that I heard you just answer Justice Krofsky that CAJ is a binding opinion that we should be bound by.
I'm going back to Justice Bradley's comment before. You just want us to find the same reasoning as CAJ today.
Well, yes, but I also think there's no reason to overrule CAJ.
Isn't part of your argument, though, would be that CAJ interpreted the language of how you do calculating, even if it was directed towards someone else. The legislature is presumed to know the law, and the understanding would be that if it uses the same or similar language, it would have the same meaning as prior cases that are considered binding precedent until otherwise would have. Right? So that's more your argument, not so much that we're bound by anything about CAJ in particular.
Sure, yes, exactly, exactly. And because the question here is whether the legislature abrogated CAJ. Mr. Yakich isn't asking this court to overrule CAJ. And we have this decision standing, this interpretation of nearly identical language standing for 30 years. So we know that the legislature hasn't abrogated CAJ.
And you want us to give no weight to the fact that they took out the language that they put in after CAJ, that in theory then was their agreement with CAJ. You want us to put no weight on that and to instead go with a theory that they were just cleaning up the statutes.
We have to theorize because we don't know exactly why they removed
it. Right, and I totally agree with that, but couldn't the theories go all kinds of ways? Couldn't it be that they wanted to abrogate CAJ?
I don't think that's the most reasonable explanation when you consider the history of the statute.
Okay.
Yeah, also when the legislature tends to overrule a case that is published, they say that's what they're doing in their decision.
Yeah.
So there can be no doubt about what they want.
I think, you know, if the legislature here in the amendments to the 2001 amendments to the NGI commitment statute had said circuit courts cannot impose consecutive commitments, that would be an explicit abrogation, and we wouldn't be here. Thank you.
All right. Council?
I'd like to begin by addressing Chief Justice Ziegler's question at the end of my initial time. The question was, if you're not able to run multiple charges that someone would have been convicted under had they been criminally responsible, consecutive to one another, how does that get essentially justice for all of the individual victims of each of those felonies? And my answer is that NGI commitments are not about getting justice for victims. It's not about punishing someone. The person has been found not guilty.
They're found guilty.
And not guilty.
And then you go to the second stage of the proceedings. You, if you're found not guilty, you're not guilty. You're first found guilty of the conduct, the criminal conduct, and then it proceeds on to the second phase, and the determination is made whether or not you are not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. If you are not guilty, you wouldn't be committed. You could not be committed if you weren't initially found guilty. So they have to stop you right there on that, right? I mean, you can't send someone under a commitment who's just found not guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, so how is victim rights compliance important at all in NGI cases, or is there an exception to victim rights compliance when it comes to NGI cases?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that.
There's no exception. I'll just give you the answer.
So Justice Grofsky is saying there is no exception for NGI commitment.
Apparently that was a question.
I couldn't help myself because I think it's
all of us
important.
But I do, again, want to focus on the policy behind NGI commitments, and I think Justice Hagedorn really kind of honed in on this. When we're talking about committing someone, we're talking about a need to treat present mental illness and present protection of the community concerns. In order for a judge to say, I think this person is presently mentally ill and the public needs protection right now, but I'm not going to start their commitment for 2 more years while they're already serving another commitment, that just practically makes no sense. A court can't know whether a person is going to be in need of mental health treatment or whether the public is going to need protected from someone 2, 3, in your example, 10 years down the road.
But that
committee can also petition the court and establish that he or she need no longer be committed for purposes of rehabilitation, treatment, or protection of the public, right?
True, Your Honor, and I disagree with counsel regarding the proper procedure. If we were to run commitments consecutive to one another, how does one petition a court? So you're under one commitment and you have a second commitment that's running consecutive. How do you petition for release from a commitment that's not even running yet?
Well, I thought the instructions before this or for the bench book, you know, did note consecutive was allowed up until the Court of Appeals decision. Hasn't this been sort of happening for a while, one way or the other?
It has been happening, Your Honor. As you can see, it happened in this case. This case, Mr. Yakich did complete his first two-year commitment prior to petitioning for discharge. So he was only serving the second three-year commitment. So,
but whatever logistical issues there may be, they probably either are worked out or maybe are for another day potentially.
The fact that DOC or DHS is doing something doesn't mean it's in compliance with the statute. It doesn't mean that if somebody is not technically serving an NGI commitment yet, that realistically DHS has the ability to release someone from a commitment that hasn't even started running yet. I also would like to address the CAJ decision briefly. Counsel stated repeatedly that this was binding precedent. However, she doesn't even correctly state the holding of CAJ. So I would like to read specifically directly from the opinion. CAJ held that a maximum term of commitment must be based on consecutive terms. The state isn't even arguing that that's actually the case today under the current statute. And it really highlights why CAJ is no longer good law. I'm not saying CAJ was wrongly decided based on the statutory language at the time, but the statute at the time really talked about calculating a maximum discharge date. And as I discussed previously, the maximum discharge date encompasses all of your commitments. So think back to criminal cases. Your maximum discharge date is going to encompass any criminal sentences that you're serving. In this case, we're talking about the authority of the court, and that authority has to be explicitly granted, and it has not been. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very interesting arguments. Thank you for your time and attention to this important case today. We'll recess and allow the second case to for presentation, and we'll be back out.